Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Early next month, the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series will host the writer and humorist Fran Lebowitz. Lebowitz, a gifted writer whose two books, Metropolitan Life and Social Studies, the latter first published 40 years ago, are consistent sellers. But she suffered from a long-running case of writer's block. Several novels have been in progress, but none ever finished, although several magazines have published excerpts. As a result, Lebowitz has reinvented herself as a public critic on issues ranging from current political issues to the issues of gentrification and political malpractices on her beloved New York City. Lebowitz moved to the city just after dropping out of high school from suburban New Jersey, and after a number of odd jobs, began writing for a small magazine on culture, Changes, which was edited by Susan Graham Mingus, then moved to Andy Warhol's publication, Interview. Through those channels, she met and befriended many of the artists, writers, and musicians that would shape the city's culture for the next 30 years. In more recent years, she's been known for two film projects with Martin Scorsese, the documentary Public Speaking, and the recent Netflix series Pretend It's a City. She's also made appearances as an actor, portraying a judge, appropriately so, on Law & Order and in Scorsese's The Wolf of Wall Street. She'll be giving the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture, sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Endowed Chair, in a virtual setting Monday evening, November 8th at 7 o'clock. Pre-registration is required. Information is at utulsa.edu/PLS. Fran Lebowitz joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Fran Lebowitz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Pretend It's a City, the Netflix series, is introduced a lot of new people to you. And it took place just before COVID and the lockdown. And now New York City is resuming its life in whatever new way it is. Has that changed your view of your beloved New York in any way at all?
No.
Nah. Okay.
No. I mean, one thing I'm not big on is changing my mind, no matter what the subject is. But I mean, during the height of the lockdown, there were many people in New York, by which I mean New Yorkers, who kept saying, this is over, New York is over, and that seemed laughable to me. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously now we're in some sort of period of flux, but truthfully, everyone's always in a period of flux. You know, it's just that not everyone's always highly aware of it. So, you know, when people say to me, what's going to happen, I don't know what's going to happen. If I could see the future, I would pick the right lottery numbers.
Well, New York has been counted out so many times, I think that the idea that you're absolutely right. It is laughable that New York's not going to be there. Has there been any change in the city that you noticed that you like better or you like less?
Well, I have to say, and this is a thing I'm not supposed to say, that I don't miss the tourists, although there are quite a few back. But that was one thing I never liked because I remember New York before. I don't mean before there were ever tourists. There were always tourists here. But, you know, when the city was going bankrupt in the early 70s, when I was living here and kind of unaware the city was going bankrupt, because if you yourself are broke, if the city's broke, you wouldn't notice. So, you know, like four guys, you know, got in a room. This is always problem causing when four guys get in a room. So four guys got in a room and said, how can we save New York from bankruptcy? And they came up with the ideas, why don't we just get money by people coming here, you know? And I thought that was a bad idea, and it was a bad idea. It made the city very prosperous. But prosperity isn't everything, and there would have been other ways to make the city prosperous. So there are tourists back. I can't remember what the date is, but they just announced that, this is a federal law. Apparently people can come here from other countries now, so that apparently people will be able to come here from other countries if they would like to, and we'll see. But to me, really the more important thing is that people go back to work. That looks like who knows if it's going to really happen, because apparently during the lockdown, everyone got to decide whether they wanted to go to work again. So, you know, I don't understand when people ever wanted to go to work. You know, but I don't think employers asked them before. So now they're asking them apparently. And it is very important, I think, to New York and really to any city that people go to work as opposed to just work at home. So, but I don't know what's going to happen with that. But if they don't come back to work, you know, the office buildings will turn into something else.
Given the fact that you had the city to yourself with other New Yorkers for a while, despite a pandemic, did you take any pleasure out of that? I mean, a small pleasure, even in the midst of everything else that was going haywire?
Well, at the height of the lockdown, you know, where, of course, you know, New York is part of the United States, even though the rest of the United States often feels it is not. So unlike Europe, for instance, where they can keep people from leaving their houses, you know, in Europe, people were not allowed to leave their house, and that's not allowed here. So I did leave, even at the height of the lockdown, and walked around by myself. Everything was closed. Every single thing was closed. And it was beyond empty. And I did say to myself, this is what you always wanted, but you didn't mean this. So this is what happens, you know. I mean, I didn't mean a fatal contagious virus. I just meant a change in tastes. It was horrible during the height of lockdown because there was a real element of sadness. You know, there were refrigerated trucks all over the place. You know, there was a hospital, like a tent. I forget what it's called, but a hospital in a tent in Central Park. So, you know, that was really the tragic element of it. And that lasted a fair amount of time. And so there was no one here then. Even New Yorkers weren't much out and about. So that was horrible. So that is not what I meant. But, you know, that's what I got.
Certainly during the lockdown and distancing during COVID, many people tried to do new things. They learned new skills, baked bread. I'm assuming you didn't do any of that.
I did not. I learned things, you know, because I was in a situation I'd never been in before. And that is something you don't expect at my age. You know, I mean, there's no real upside to being old, but this maybe slight upside is that almost everything that happens to you kind of after you're 40 reminds you of something else that happened to you. You know, this is why, you know, people who are younger might ask you advice, you know, but when this happened, this reminded me of nothing. There was nothing like this in my lifetime. And so I was really unable to, you know, it was hard for me to figure out a way to think about it. The only new habit I acquired was I became addicted to doing crossword puzzles, which I had never done in my life. I hate games. I don't care what kind of games they are. And when people would say, why don't you like this game? I would always say, because it's a game. And I grew up. But crossword puzzles, I did become addicted to, and I have maintained this addiction.
That it's a very funny. I did the same thing.
It's very, I don't know what the word is. It's relaxing. I couldn't think of the word because it's so infrequent that actually occurs here.
You were talking earlier about the 1970s in New York, and it was a tough time in New York. You've often said that when younger people come here, you speak, they always say, I wish I could have been in New York back in the 70s. I was coming of age in the 70s, and I don't particularly remember that as glory days. In fact, everything I remember was there was a lot of people saying, I wish it was the 50s, which also wasn't a great era. What is your reaction to that when they say, I wish I could have been here in the 70s? Do you understand it?
I've come to understand it because it's been happening for so long, and it happens in the street. I mean, all the time kids come up to me and say this, and they've been doing this for quite some time, so I assume they're different kids. but, I think the reason for this is that New York in the 70s as an era has achieved this kind of glow-in-the-dark quality, you know, like Paris in the 20s or something, because everyone knows I'm of the age where I was in New York in the 70s. They asked me about it. For kids to wish, you know, that is, I don't think, the best thing for the future of the country. I mean, I know that when I was in my 20s, I didn't go up to old people and say, I wish I lived in New York in the 30s. I think nostalgia, you know, which often, by the way, occurs in people who are nostalgic for an era they didn't live through, is much easier because, of course, no matter what the era is, you know, the things that people know of it are so out of context. It's like the 50s. You know, whenever people talk about the 50s, I was a child in the 50s. But whenever people talk about the 50s, they talk about, you know, these kind of lighthearted things. Cars, how great the American cars were, which I did love those cars in the 50s. You know, certain kinds of popular music. But they never talk about the really bad stuff in the 50s. There was a lot of really bad. There's always a lot of bad stuff. It doesn't matter whether it's the 1950s, the 1850s. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You know, but I think this New York in the 70s thing looks to me like it's going to last quite a while.
Mm. You were talking about New York and how New York decided to attract tourists. It's very funny that, you know, basically every other American city that had some of the same problems, maybe to a lesser degree than New York, did exactly the same thing. Even a city the size of Tulsa, it's about how can we bring people to spend money to pay the taxes instead of us?
Yeah, it's a bad thing. I think tourism is a bad thing for any place, you know, instead of a good thing. You know, it is always, I believe, a bad thing. First of all, if the place is great to begin with, let's say Venice, okay? Venice is, you know, a unique, remarkable city to the entire world and has been for centuries. There used to be fewer tourists in Venice. Well, now, I don't know, the second. But and when these massive numbers of tourists started going to Venice, it ruins every place. Now, not just a place that's so fragile as Venice is, you know, but it ruins every place because it becomes a place for tourists. You know, even though people live there, and especially, you know, I mean, especially a place like Venice, which apparently Venetians no longer can even live in Venice. Also, they invent things, you know, in the meantime, they invented these cruise ships the size of, you know, apartment complexes, you know, and they allow them to come right into Venice, which they shouldn't. You know, the people who run city governments are very often very short-sighted because what they're concerned about is what can I do in the 5 minutes I'm in office that'll make me look like a hero? You know, so I think that's a problem everywhere. I mean, I'm not familiar with Tulsa, but I'm sure there are things about Tulsa that people who are from Tulsa, you know, objected to them doing in order to attract tourists to Tulsa.
Now, it's interesting you're talking about the wealth needed to live in Venice. It's certainly requires enormous wealth to live in New York. You're a critic of that and have been for a while. Do you expect post-pandemic for that to change for the better, or will it just keep getting worse?
The thing is that, you know, real estate prices went down quite a bit. I mean, it's the height of COVID, you know, and this is something that, you know, say, you know, the Times and, you know, the local media was tracking all the time. And people who owned apartments were worried about it, people who rented apartments. So there was a period where rents, for instance, went quite a bit lower. Still, I have the news for people. Even when rents go down in New York, they're still more than they are anyplace else. You know, I mean, New York is always very expensive, even when it's, you know, less expensive than it was, you know, a week ago, and it will always go back up. So the prices did go down. That was a very good thing. You know, I mean, not good enough, you know, to counteract the fact that there was a fatal contagious virus, but the prices did go down, which did enable kids, and I know kids who did this, to come to New York for the first time. And I said, look, sign the longest lease you can. Because the second they can jack those prices up, they will, and they did.
You know, you said that when you moved to New York, there was wealth, but there was always a way to make money and get by. Are those days over?
I think, well, they're over to a certain extent. I mean, the one thing was when I came to New York when I was a kid, one thing you could count on was there was an enormous number of bad jobs. You could always get a bad job. They were available all the time. And I was changing bad jobs every, you know, week practically, you know, every 2 weeks I would think, I hate this job. Let's see if there's a better job. Oh, this looks like I would hate this less. And finally, I realized I just hate to work so that it wouldn't even matter. If the job I'd gotten was Secretary of State, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it. I would have liked it more than, you know, selling belts on the street, which I did. It was very easy to get those kind of jobs. And also, there were no requirements, you know, for anything. I mean, applying for those kind of jobs, you would go to the place. Everyone handed the same form that asked you just nothing, like your name, you know, maybe your address, I don't even remember. They paid you in cash at the end of every day. So it was a very good thing, you know, because if you could wake up with no money, which I did frequently, and at the end of the day, you had some money. So that doesn't exist anymore. It's not a possibility. And I don't think that will come back. I mean, the one thing I think that is a good thing that I've noticed, that's not just New York, but because of these labor shortages all over the place, finally, you know, employers are starting to have to pay people, you know, I wouldn't say a living wage. It's so interesting, you know, what rich people think other people should live on.
Right.
You know, I bet it's always like when Bloomberg was the mayor, he like went around showing they were building some building on these things called micro apartments. They were like 10 by 10. You could barely, like, it would not be a good place to store one pair of shoes. And I say, you know, I don't know about you, but I find it kind of horrible that a billionaire is showing people how they can live, you know, in 10 square inches of space.
In a cell, basically. In a cell.
In a cell, basically. But the kind of wealth that exists now in the world, not just in New York, it didn't exist before. You never heard the word billion, okay? I never heard that word. Now, when a kid describes a rich person, they say a billionaire. No one says millionaire anymore. Like, that's nothing, you know? when I started, the first time I heard the word trillion, I had to ask someone what it was. Oh. I said, what is that? It's 1,000 billion. That's what a trillion is. And I said at the time, and I believe that now, no one should use that word who's not an astronomer.
That's good. My guest today is Fran Lebowitz, author, social commentator, featured in the Netflix series Pretend It's a City, Conversations with Martin Scorsese. She'll be the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture, presented by the Darcy O'Brien Endowed Chair in a virtual lecture Monday evening, November 8th. And she's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, can we talk a little bit about politics? You've said that this is a source of a great deal of rage in your life, and it's been up higher. Where are we as far as our democracy? I think some people think that January 6th failed, Biden was sworn in, everything's fine. Others are completely seething that Trump still isn't president. And many people are warning that democracy is very much in danger. Where do you stand?
Oh, it's very much in danger. It's hanging by a thread. You know, I go around doing speaking dates when you could go around. I've done this, you know, since I was in my late 20s. And always in election years, all the questions from the audience about politics, that's always been the case. During the Trump campaign, I mean, the Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump campaign, I went around the country and told literally thousands of people with total assurance, zero. He has zero chance of winning because I believe that. You know, and after that election, for at least 6 months, I couldn't walk out my door without people yelling at me in the street, "You were wrong! You were wrong!" Yes, I know that. And believe me, I'm sorry. In every possible way, I'm sorry that I was wrong. Because in New York, Trump is always such a joke that it never occurred to me that anyone would vote for him for the president. I mean, he couldn't be the president of my condo board. You know, I mean, there's no organization, no matter how small or insignificant, that he could have been the president of in New York City. So in New York City, no one even thought he was a real estate developer. The real estate developers looked down at him, and that's not exactly your finest group of people. So that I knew about this television show, but I never saw it. But, you know, a friend of mine said right before the election, she said, you know, he could win. And I said, that's ridiculous. And she said, you know, you don't understand the United States because you don't watch reality television. And it's true, I don't watch reality television. I knew people did watch it, but it never occurred to me they thought it was reality, you know, so that I knew there were a lot of stupid people in the country, but I didn't know there were this many. I really didn't. Now I do, and it's not a source of happiness to me to know this. January 6th was one of the most shocking days of my life. I would say I was as shocked by that as I was by September 11th. Mm. And truthfully, in the end, this could be, you know, without the 3,000 people dying, as dangerous. And then to have people say this didn't really happen, every single person, you know, practically in the country saw this live. So now we live in a world where it doesn't matter what you see. It doesn't matter what happens. And, you know, just the fact that, for instance, apparently Steve Bannon has not complied with a subpoena from Congress, they learned this from Trump.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, before this, you know, there was no idea that you would be subpoenaed and you wouldn't show up. It's not a possibility. Now, apparently, it doesn't matter what you do. So this is, I don't know how this gets repaired. I can tell you that. I mean, I was very relieved when Biden was elected. Of course, it was a great relief. I never really liked Joe Biden, I have to tell you. But I was also very glad when he won the primary because I thought he was the only one who could win the election. I mean, I didn't want him to be the president. I wanted Elizabeth Warren to be the president. But it never, you know, I know there's never going to be a woman president in my lifetime. That is very clear. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm very glad he's the president because he's, you know, not Donald Trump. I can't say I'm optimistic about the future of this. I don't understand why people aren't more concerned about it. You know, it's not a joke. You know, I mean, some of these things may strike people as funny, but it's not funny. And it's highly dangerous.
I think a lot of people have checked out. I think they've checked out because it is just, you know, the rage, the numbness, the constant. Really, I think that our whole society today is based on rage and fear. And either emotion is designed to sell you on something. So I think a lot of people have checked out. And I think that's very dangerous.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I guess people didn't. The fact of not believing what is clearly right in front of you, you know, this alternative world that people seem to be able to live in, you know, the fact that apparently close to half the country thinks that Donald Trump really won the election. Every piece of evidence is the opposite. You know, I don't know what, I mean, I know they, you know, go on the internet and they see all this, you know, fake stuff. And I don't know, like, how you avoid knowing any facts. You know, but to me, it's literally like you're standing in the pouring rain and the person standing next to you is saying it's not raining. You know, I don't understand how this occurs. I understand why people want to think this, you know, but in the end, these people, you know, it's bad for them. But they don't seem, I think people, they seem to care less. We live really now so much in a world of symbols. People are much more concerned with what statue is there than, you know, what is actually going on in Congress. You know, people are more concerned with what people say than what people do. It's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, you said you don't think there will ever be a woman president. Why do you believe that?
I said in my lifetime.
No, in your lifetime.
So
okay.
Maybe eventually, you know, which is not, you know, decades and decades to come, let's face it. So I'm hoping there will be one. I would like there to be one. But I did always say, you know, even 20 years ago, that I believe there would be a black male president before there was a woman president. And I was right about that. You know, there are tons of countries, including countries that, you know, Americans have often referred to as third world countries that have had women leaders. But we've never had a woman mayor in New York.
That's
you know,
true.
This is a very strong thing in this country. So, you know, I would love there to be one president, not just any woman, obviously, even after we've had numbers of men who are like even less than just any man. I mean, I've never known anyone in my personal life anywhere near as stupid as Donald Trump. Okay, so anyone. Okay, so, you know, apparently any man will do. But Elizabeth Warren, is, you know, of all the people running in the Democratic primary, was clearly the smartest. Smart is really important in a president. People seem to discount this as a trait we might like in a president, but it's a really, really hard job. So it would be really a good idea for someone very smart to do this job. But I don't, you know, I would love there to be a woman president, but I'm not waiting for this to happen.
Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of like we want a smart person to be president, but we don't want him to look like he's smart.
There's a real anti-intellectual strain in American life, and it has always been there. And that is not true everywhere in the world. And, you know, people think that, you know, very smart people look down on people who are not very smart. And that is probably true. But so what? You know, I mean, when I was, you know, going around the last, during the Clinton-Trump campaign, lots of people would say to me, I don't like Hillary Clinton. And I would say, so what? You're not going to meet her. You don't have to like the president. You have to like your friends. Okay? The president is probably a person you're never going to meet. And you're not going to, it's not like Hillary Clinton's going to drive you crazy. When are we having dinner? You know, I really think it doesn't matter whether the president is likable. You know, it's like doctors. You know, what, I don't care if I like the doctor. I care, or you were a very good doctor. You know, like, you know, there are certain things that are very important. And what really matters is the person very good at this job. Now, this is a person very charming or very, you know, compatible with you, you know, while you have dinner with them or whatever. It doesn't matter to me. So, you know, this idea that politicians have to be likable, you know, is to me a silly idea.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I was wondering if Fran Lebowitz, we could talk about some of the people that have been in a part of your life at one point or another, just a brief comment about them. For example, you talk a bit about Charles Mingus in Pretend It's a City. You were acquainted, friendly, if you could be that around Mingus. I really think Mingus is probably Duke Ellington and Mingus, the greatest jazz composer's music has ever produced. What did you like most about him and his music?
Well, he certainly was one of the greatest, no question. You know, I mean, we use the word genius all the time in this country to refer to people who are not even, you know, kind of sentient. So he was a great composer. He was a great musician. You know, he was a very difficult person as a person. And the only person I ever saw him, he was very arrogant, as you might imagine. The only person I ever saw him defer to was Duke Ellington. He was incredibly deferential to Duke Ellington. I had actually breakfast with them once, you know. And by which I mean, you know, like at 5 a.m. after, you know, I think after Ellington played here. And he was incredibly deferential to him. Charles obviously thought that Duke Ellington was a superior composer to him. I wouldn't say that I think that's true. You know, they were very different. Also, Duke Ellington had fired Charles from a band at one point. And he just, you know, he worshipped him. So that, he was a great artist, Charles, a great artist.
Yeah. In fact, Mingus, one of his best pieces is Duke Ellington's Sound of Love, which he wrote, I guess, for Duke Ellington. Yeah. Toni Morrison was a very close friend of yours.
Yeah, very close. And Toni was one of my closest friends. That's not true of Charles, but Toni was one of my closest friends. And I, you know, I miss Toni every day, but truthfully, when COVID first appeared, this man, Errol, who's my editor and her editor and a friend of mine and hers, I talked to him on the phone in the first, like, week, and I said, don't you miss Tony even more? And he said, yes. And the reason for that is that, you know, in my lifetime, I've known a lot of very smart people, but I've known only one wise person, and that was Tony. And I said, Tony would know how to think about this, because the first thing that was bothering me was, how do I even think about this thing? And even though Tony was older than me, but she wasn't old enough to have remembered the, you know, 1918 flu epidemic, Tony, I would have said, Tony, how are we supposed to think about this? And she would have known. So, you know, Tony was, you know, when I was a kid, my mother used to say to me, can't you be the bigger person? Can't you be the bigger person? And at a certain point, I realized, no, I'm by nature the smaller person. But the bigger person was Tony. And she was the biggest person I've ever known. She was the most humane, you know, the most, like, expansive human, on top of obviously a great, you know, writer. But in addition to being a great writer, she was a very spectacular example of a human being.
Martin Scorsese. I think Martin is there to laugh at whatever you say, but he seems like you guys are friendly and good friends.
Yeah, Marty's a good friend of mine. Marty, by the way, himself is hilarious. You know, you don't see that and pretend it's a city, but he is a really funny, funny person. Marty also is a shockingly intelligent person, by which I mean he is way smarter than you have to be a movie director. I mean, you see, like, how incredibly talented he is if you see his movies, but he is really, really a brilliant guy. And also fun. Fun is very important. Tony was also fun. And he's incredibly well-read, Marty. I mean, incredibly well-read. Marty has been in your state for over a year. He just got back.
Yes, I know. Yeah, he's
been... he made a movie there. Uh-huh. And he just got back like a week ago. He was there for a year, I think. He did make some effort to get me to go out there, but he failed at this. it was a book. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah.
When I first heard he was doing this, I said, what do you mean you're going to Oklahoma? I mean, he is the most urban person you could imagine. Like, you can't even imagine him in a suburb, let alone in Oklahoma. You know, and he was describing to me, I said, what do you mean? Someone said to me, well, there's this guy coming, and it'll be good to take care of the horses. I said, horses? The idea of Marty even being on the same planet as a horse. You know, I mean, he is not Mr. Nature, I can assure you of that. So that I can't wait to see this movie. But I also, I did talk to him several times on Zoom or Face, whatever you call this stuff. And I just couldn't, I mean, even though I was seeing him there, I was seeing him in a room in the house he rented. You know, and I did say to someone, is Marty on a horse? I said, no, Marty's in this. Marty's is an SUV. He's not on a horse. That's an impossible image, I have to say.
Well, we look forward to your lecture virtually at the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture. Fran Lebowitz, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you.
Writer and humorist Fran Lebowitz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She was recently featured in the Netflix series with Martin Scorsese, Pretend It's a City. And she'll be the guest of the University of Tulsa's Presidential Lecture Series, sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Chair, Monday evening, November 8th at 7 o'clock. The lecture will be virtual, and you need to pre-register, and you can learn more at utulsa.edu/PLS. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.